Acts 9. We looked at verses 1 and 2 last week. 2 weeks ago, we checked out some information from the life of Paul. If you were here last week, we got through most of what we have in Acts 9, 1 and 2. In that second verse of Acts 9, the text says, "And asked him," that would be the high priest, "letters of Damascus unto the synagogues, that if he found any that were of the way," we didn't talk about that expression, but that's where we begin today, "he found any that were the way, whether men or women, he might bring them bound to Jerusalem." And then, of course, that would have resulted in some further persecution. When you look at that second verse in Acts chapter 9, it is an interesting expression, and you do find Christianity referred to as the way some other times in this book. We'll see it a little bit later in Acts chapter 19 and verse 9. We'll also see it in Acts 19 and verse 23, and then over in chapter 24, verses 14 and 22. But you never find the expression, the way, applied to Christianity outside the book of Acts. Now, Luke doesn't explain why he refers to Christianity or why others were referring to Christianity as the way. I do think that there are some good possibilities. For example, when you think about the way, what would come to mind? It is the way. It's the way. Why? All right, you think about John chapter 14 and verse 6. Jesus said, "I'm the way, the truth, and the life. No one cometh unto the Father but by me," so it might go back to that. Anything else? The way. Tim?
Mm-hmm. The only way. Okay. So when we see that phrase, we know that that's the only way that we can access Jesus.
Okay, it's the only way to God. It's the only way to salvation. It's the only right way to live. So when we talk to people today, there might be multiple ways to get to a certain place, but you also have times where there's only one road. So somebody says, "What is the way?" They recognize that there's only one way. And that may be what we're talking about when we look at this. In the New Testament, we do find the word way used in some other ways. For example, in Matthew 21 and verse 32, we read about the way of righteousness. We read about the way of God and the way of the Lord a little bit later in the book of Acts. That'll be in Acts chapter 18, verses 25 and 26. Early in Luke, the first chapter, Luke chapter 1 and verse 79, and this is also in Romans chapter 3 and verse 17, the Bible talks about the way of peace. And then you have the way of truth, 2 Peter chapter 2 and verse 2. A little bit later in Acts chapter 16 and verse 17, we're going to read about the way of salvation. We're also going to find the way of commandment, 2 Corinthians 8 and verse 8. Peter again, 2 Peter 2 and verse 21, there's the way of righteousness. And then as someone mentioned, John chapter 14 and verse 6, Jesus said, "I am the way." So all those statements, all those descriptions point out the kinds of things that Tim was alluding to earlier. There is a specific way, there is a specific path, and the opposite of that is, if there is the right way, then we would be inclined to infer that there is also the wrong way. And what would the wrong ways include, generally speaking?
Man's ideas.
All right, man's ideas, man's philosophies when it comes to the religious realm, and the devil's too. And ultimately, the ideas from men are going to come from the devil. But there are certainly many of those. All right, then you also have, not only in the New Testament, we might not think about this, but we also have in the Old Testament, oftentimes, the word way being used. If you were to go back to Genesis chapter 3 and verse 24, there's information as far as the way to the tree of life. That's kind of an interesting word that you find associated with the tree of life. Abraham is described as someone who would direct his family, Genesis 18 and verse 19, in the way of Jehovah. You have in Exodus chapter 18 and verse 20 the word must, along with the word way. And that's not something that we see so much with the New Testament, but there is a way which not only we should take, but a way that we must take if we want to be in a right relationship with God. There's condemnation about quickly turning from the right way, Exodus 32 and verse 8. You have over there in Numbers chapter 21 and verse 4 that people can face discouragement as they're headed along the right way. And living according to the ways of God is a way to be blessed, Deuteronomy chapter 5 and verse 33. You also have in Judges chapter 2 and verse 17, when a new generation arises, there's danger that the new generation is not going to follow in what? The right way, the right path. And sometimes people say they're following the way of God, but the claim's false, 1 Samuel 15 and verse 20. And God's not fooled in those cases, 1 Samuel 15 and verse 19. So that's just kind of a quick reference. We could have run those passages, but I didn't, because that's not really where I want to focus. I do, though, want you to see that when you come to the word way in the Bible, whether it's in the Old Testament or the word as it's used in the New Testament, the way of God or the way of righteousness, this is a pretty significant idea. So it's not surprising that in the New Testament, here in Acts chapter 9, you read about the way. Bonnie?
It makes me think about, I believe it was back in the 80s, Stan and Marcia might be acquainted with it. Over in Rome City, there was this big, big thing. It was called the way, and it was a cult in there, I believe, and they were self-sufficient within themselves there, and was that back in the 80s?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
That's what I thought.
Yeah, it's very descriptive. Yeah, it's very descriptive terminology. When people talk about the way, I mean, that sounds like it's a very distinctive group. And people have, I think, picked up on that. I might be wrong. I'd have to go back and look at this, but I believe that there is a Bible translation which is referred to as the way. So don't quote me on that, but I'm thinking that that is correct. That thought didn't come up until class today, just a minute ago. But again, it's a way to, well, there's the word again. It's a way to tell you that there is a particular path to go. That it? Jenny, and then we'll take Stan's thought.
When the church that I worked with over in Romania, when they first went in 1990 after communism fell, they weren't allowed to call themselves, have the word church. Nobody was allowed to have the word church, so they were the way of Christ.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right, and there are a lot of ways to designate the church, a lot of ways to designate disciples, and we'll pick up more on that in just a minute, but you're absolutely correct. Stan?
Matthew 7:13, enter ye at the straight gate, for wide is the gate, and broad is the way that leadeth to destruction, and many there be that go thereat. I like that verse because it has both ends of it. It has the positive and the negative.
Yeah. And like I say, it is a very important word in Scripture. And you can, like I say, probably find dozens of passages where you would find some point of application. Is that it? All right, let's talk about for a second, before we get to Acts 9, 3, and 4, some of the ways, there's that word again, or some of the figures that are used to describe God's people in Scripture. We're going to find a little bit later, Acts 11 and verse 26, Christians were called disciples. When you think about the word disciple, what comes to mind? Somebody says, you're a disciple. What are they saying about you? Or you say, I'm a disciple. All right, I think follower would come to mind. What else? All right, commitment would perhaps spring to mind. Anything else?
Student.
All right, I'm a learner. I'm a student. I'm trying to get more information about this philosophy, this path, or you could use that word way again. When you think about the description in places like Galatians chapter 3, 26 and 27, I'm a son, I'm a daughter. What would be implied by that terminology? All right, there is that. When you think about a son, and this is not going to be true perhaps for the entire period of life, but somebody says, this is my son, this is my daughter, especially in those younger years, what's implied in that? They're living in the household at the age of 8, 10, 12. What's still going on?
Instruction.
All right, there's still instruction, there's still a period of growth, and you might think when they're 40, they're still learning. Or they need to learn some things. But still, oftentimes when you see that word, that's what comes to mind. And that's also going to be true as well when you think about the Christian. What about the word priest? That's applied to Christians. 1 Peter chapter 2 and verse 5. Somebody says, I'm a priest. I'm a member of the way and I'm a priest. What did priests do? They made sacrifices. Well, isn't that true for the Christian? We make sacrifices. The Hebrew writer talked about the sacrifice of praise continually over there in Hebrews chapter 13, and we also do that. Somebody says, well, I like that description over there in 1 Corinthians 1, verses 1 and 2. That description would be saint. What comes to mind when you use that description? A saint.
Sanctified.
All right. Sanctified, set apart, someone who's trying to live a life which is distinct, a life committed to God. When you look at our religious world, sometimes they'll use that word to describe the deceased. That's not how the Bible describes it. The Bible describes saints as people who are trying to live for God. You have that description over there in John chapter 15 as far as branches. Jesus said, every branch in me that doesn't, remember those next couple words? Bear fruit. So he identifies what the function of a branch is. A branch should bear fruit. So if we're looking at the church, the way, from the perspective of a branch, what does that tell you? You're not going to be a pew sitter. You're going to be a... Somebody said it.
Worker.
You're going to be a worker. You're going to be a fruit bearer. Don, did you have a thought there? Okay. All right, let's see what else we've got over here. When you have Ephesians 6, 10 to 18 read, you're going to have Paul talking about the Christian from the standpoint of a soldier. When you use that analogy to describe Christians, what comes to mind? You're a soldier. Well, okay, there's going to be some kind of conflict. There's going to be battle. You need to be prepared, have the armor, and so forth. It's going to be ongoing activity. We're a steward, Matthew 25, verses 14 through 30. What does that bring to mind? Somebody says, I'm a steward. Okay, what do you probably possess?
Well, you're caring for something.
All right, you're caring for something. It may not necessarily be money. It might be a house that you've been entrusted with, but you're tending to something. You have some kind of oversight. When you think about Christians, they're stewards of the gospel. And then one more. Peter said, 1 Peter chapter 2 and verse 11, we are pilgrims. What comes to mind when you think about a pilgrim? All right, a sojourner, someone says, this is not my real home. I'm here from another place, and I'm probably not going to stay here, or at least not stay here for very long. So when you look at the church, it's described with a lot of figures. When you look at the individuals, the people who make up the church, the same is true. And you have all those different descriptions given so we can help understand what the church is collectively, and so we can help understand not only for our own selves, but to explain it to others what Christians are supposed to be like. Anything you want to add or ask before we look at Acts 9, 3, and 4? Stan?
Well, back to the son or daughter, that brings to mind to me someone who inherits, mm-hmm. and we will definitely inherit some good things.
Yeah, sometimes kids are cut out of the will. That can also be true spiritually, but ideally you continue to do what you need to be a member in good standing of the family. That's also true spiritually, and there is some kind of inheritance. So that there's that aspect as well. That it? All right, let's take a look at verses 3 and 4 in Acts chapter 9. And as he, that's Saul of Tarsus, who becomes Paul, and as he journeyed, it came to pass that he drew nigh into Damascus. And suddenly there shone round about him a light out of heaven. And he fell upon the earth and heard a voice saying unto him, Saul, Saul, why persecutest thou me? So we have Saul. Where is he headed to? He's on the road which leads to Damascus. There were multiple roads that led to that city. And there's this light out of heaven that appears. Now again, when you have some images like this, it's very important. In this case, the image is light. You remember 1 John chapter 1 and verse 5? God is
the light.
All right, God is light. So that's one of the qualities, one of the characteristics that is associated with God. And is that quality, is that characteristic also associated with God's people as far as light? Sure. When you think about Matthew chapter 5 and verse 14, Sermon on the Mount, Jesus said, you're not the darkness of the world, you are the light of the world. And not only are you the light of the world, he said, you're like a city set on a hill. And what do you do with your light? He said, you don't put it under the bushel and hide it. Your light needs to be displayed before all. When we think about the word light, it's an image that's used elsewhere over in the book of Romans, chapter 13 and verse 12. Paul associates the word light with armor. And Satan knows the power of that light. Paul made that point to the Corinthians in 2 Corinthians chapter 4 and verse 4 when he said, Satan seeks to blind people. If you're a blind person, now again, there would be some exceptions to that perhaps, but if you're a blind person, what's light going to do for you? I mean, it's not going to be very helpful because the eyes need to be able to see and process the light, so it's going to be useful. And not only does Satan seek to blind people to the light, you remember that other passage over there in the 2 Corinthians letter, 2 Corinthians chapter 11 and verse 4, 2 Corinthians 11 and verse 14 rather. Paul talked about Satan and he said he fashions himself into, do you remember, an angel of light. Well, the devil knows that light's productive. The devil knows that the light is going to be appealing to some people. So if he can't ensnare people in some other ways, he says, well, look, I will go ahead and appear to be a righteous being. I'll not come to you in the form of sin. I'll come to you in the form of religion. I'll come to you in the form of something that sounds good and pleasant, something that's appealing to you, and a religion that seems attractive to you, and offer that. Well, there's another passage over there in the 2 Corinthians letter. Paul had apparently a lot to say about light to the Corinthians. And he said, 2 Corinthians 6 and verse 14, light and what don't go together? Don't be unequally yoked. Light and darkness don't go together. And then John chapter 3 and verse 19, he made the point that not everybody likes the light. There are some people who love moral and spiritual darkness. Now, we've talked before about the fact that there are people in life who, when they find anything miraculous in the Bible, they will go to great lengths to explain it away. They will say, well, that's not a miracle. That's not supernatural. That can be explained by naturalistic means. Well, guess what we have here? Paul and the people who are with them, we don't know exactly who those people were. Maybe they were Jewish soldiers. Maybe they were Roman soldiers. Maybe they were just people who wanted to travel with Paul. Nothing is said about the identities of these people. So we just know that some people were with Paul. And they are on the road. We're going to see a little bit later that they all fall down because of the light. And there are some people who come to this and they say, oh no, it can't be a miracle. Want to guess how they try to explain it away? This is really creative. Huh? No. Right. We're back to the crucifixion there. Anybody want to take a stab at how they try to explain away Acts 9, 3, and 4? Well, there have been some people who have said, well, this was a sudden thunderstorm. And in the great, there you go. In the great thunderstorm, there was also some lightning. And then, if that doesn't quite fit the bill, they would say, well, it was Paul. He got struck by a lightning bolt. And, I mean, you look at the text and you look at the explanation and you think, are you kidding? I mean, is that really the explanation that you want to advance and offer? But there are some people who say, oh, yes. Well, there are some problems with that, one of which the word for light is never used for lightning. Now, that may in and of itself not be definitive, but at least I think that is an important point. Then, if that doesn't work, they would say, well, Paul, he's out there on this road, and, you know, he's angry, he's all worked up, and he just has sunstroke. It's a really hot day. Well, there's a little bit of a problem with that. Take a look at Acts chapter 26 and verse 14, and then Don will take your hand after that. Acts 26 and verse 14. And stay there for a second. We'll also ask you to look at Acts chapter 26 and verse 13. All right, 26:14. Bonnie, you have it?
And when we were all fallen to the earth, I heard a voice speaking unto me and saying in the Hebrew tongue, Saul, Saul, why persecutest thou me?
Okay, that's enough. Thank you. How many fell?
All.
They all did. So if this is sunstroke, who had it?
Everybody
did. So again, when you start looking at the text, thankfully we have three accounts, and we'll back up to verse 13 in just a bit. All right, Don, let's go back to you.
Well, just a beam of light that they've shown on Paul so that everybody in that group knew that it was Paul. But they didn't hear anything.
Yes. Let's put your question on the back burner for just a little bit. I think we're going to, if not address all of it, we'll address most of it, and then we can come back and talk about it a bit more. Okay, let's develop some other things. This is kind of where Don was heading us. Bonnie, you still there in Acts 26?
Yeah.
Let's back up one verse and see what we have in Acts 26 and verse 13, because, as I said, we have three accounts of Paul's conversion, and when we look at Acts 26, we find some details that are not recorded back in Acts 9. So Acts 26, 13.
At midday, O king, I saw on the way a light from heaven above the brightness of the sun shining round about me, and them which journeyed with me.
Okay, just stay there for a bit. We're going to flip back and forth a couple times, Acts 9 and Acts chapter 26. In Acts 26, what's the time of day? He says it was
midday.
What time of day would you associate that with?
Noon.
So, time of day when the sun should really be out and forceful. All right, if we go back to Acts chapter 9 and verse 3, we find the quickness or the suddenness. How quickly did it happen? All right, suddenly, and that's an important word. That's an adverb. It occurs just a few times in the New Testament. Jesus used an adverb over in the book of Mark, chapter 13 and verse 36, to describe his second coming. When you think about a second coming, how quick is that going to be? It's going to be faster than I just snap my fingers. It's also used of the Lord's birth in Luke chapter 2 and verse 13, and the quickness of a demon's attacks on a child, Luke chapter 9 and verse 39, and then here as we look at Paul's conversion. All right, when you look at how that word is used in the New Testament, a couple of lessons emerge from it. First of all, I think that word suggests that God works in his own timetable. That's a lesson that's tough for a lot of people. It's, well, we want this now. And people will look to God as far as prayer or something else, and they're thinking God should act, and he should act on our own timetable. God will act, and he will often act swiftly, sometimes in a way that's very unexpected, but He's going to do it when the time is correct. The second thing I think that I would point out with that is that when people have an encounter with God, you especially see this when miracles were being performed, it was an unforgettable experience. Today people say, well, I had this encounter with God, and they kind of brush it off. That's not what you find in Scripture. All right, going back to some of the things that we find in the text. Let's go back. Bonnie, still in Acts chapter 26?
Yes.
All right, let's go back to Acts 26 and verse 14. Let's just stop right there, because you got the key part. We all did what? We all fell to the earth. Now, when you find people who had some kind of experience with God, there was a manifestation. Falling to the ground was a very common thing. You see that? One example would be back in the book of Ezekiel, chapter 1 and verse 28. You also find that not only with the manifestation of God's glory, you find that even with angels, people were so shaken from the experience, they fell to the ground. An example of that would be Daniel chapter 8, verses 15 through 17. If you think about the disciples, they were with the Lord. They see Jesus' glory. Do you remember what happened to them? Matthew 17 and verse 6. They also fell to the ground. Now, as you look at this, you have people. Revelation 1 and verse 17 would be an example of what I'm talking about now. After people fell to the ground, you have, generally speaking, a command that says either don't fear, it's okay, you're not going to die. Or the other command is get up. Something needs to be done. You've shown respect and we understand that you have the right attitude. Get up and don't fear. But as you look at Paul, that's not what we find. And that's very, very interesting. Let's take a look. Again, Bonnie, read Acts 26 and verse 14. And then I want somebody to read Acts chapter 9 and verse 7. Who wants to be our Acts 9, 7 reader? We're going to have these back to back. Acts 9, 7. All right, that'll be Lois. 26:14, and again, I'm going to stop you, Bonnie.
And when we were all fallen to the
there earth, it is. How many fell? We
all
fell. All right, Acts 9:7, Lois.
And the men who traveled with him stood speechless.
Okay, that's enough. Thank you. All right, see the problem? Acts 26:14 says how many fell? All did. Acts chapter 9, verse 7, what do we have? They're stood. They're standing. Well, people who like to criticize the Bible, and we're not afraid of honest investigation, but there are some people who, even after all the criticisms have been answered, they still don't want to believe. This conflict, if we can use that word, this alleged contradiction is one that they love to turn to and say, aha, you can't have it both ways. These guys stood, these guys fell. Well, if you're asked about this at work tomorrow, what would you say? Well, that might be possible. Tim?
Well, they couldn't have fallen unless they were standing. If they were already down, they didn't fall. They were already down. So they had to be up to get down. So
I'm going to explain it in a different way, but I think you're on the right track, okay? I'm going to give you that and just stop you right there. But I think you're headed in the right direction. Anybody else want to take a stab at this? Jenny? Okay. Anybody else want to? All right, Steve?
So they were still. They just made them be still and not moving.
Yes, ma'am.
You're forgetting this is wrong. There's different cultures. Maybe the ones who are still standing still showing respect.
Could be.
From their culture.
Okay. A nice thought, Ray?
I'm not sure that means that they were standing up. I think it might even mean that they were just speechless at that time. They were not able, and we use that expression sometimes too. We stood there for that, but we weren't standing, we were sitting.
Well, let me toss this out for your consideration. Out of all the answers, and they were all thoughtful, I think Tim is probably closest to headed in the right direction. Go back to where I was, and I laid the foundation for this. Think about when men had an interchange with God or angels. Remember what we said from those passages. We didn't run the references, but there's this manifestation of God, or there's this angel, or whatever takes place, people typically fall. All right? And then, as we said from Revelation chapter 1, John, what's he told to do?
Get up.
It seems like, for the most part, the guys don't spend too long on the ground. So you have these fellows who are with Saul. We don't know who they were. My understanding is they fall to the ground. Everybody falls, Acts 26 and verse 14. But everybody but Saul then does what?
Stands up.
That's consistent with what you find in Scripture. But there's no indication that Saul immediately got up. Why do you think he might have stayed on the ground for a little bit?
He was being talked to.
Well, I think that's a big part of it. And what else? What's he done?
Is it fear?
I think you have to begin to wonder a little bit. Hey, I thought that I was on this great mission for God. All of a sudden, and then we're going to see this, not today, but there's another quote-unquote alleged contradiction as far as hearing the voice. One account says he heard the voice. The other account says the people with him didn't hear the voice. And somebody says, well, look, that's a contradiction. No, it's not. Because the word which is translated here has the sense of understand. So there's something going on with Saul that's not going on with the other guys. And because of that, that's one more piece of information that inclines me to believe these guys, they had their experience, they fall down to the ground, and then they get back up. Saul, though, is remaining on the ground because there is this definite interaction with him. One source said this: the experience of Saul was definite. There must be no uncertainties in the conversion experience of, he refers to him as the chief apostle. I wouldn't necessarily use that language. If Saul was expecting a commendation from above, he surely got one of the biggest surprises of his life. I think that's exactly right. So it's not that you have a contradiction, it's that you have two different things happening here. So if you have never noticed that before and somebody brings that up, don't just say, oh man, let's call Brad. You've already figured it out. But anyway, Carol? Right. And they try to bring out what I think has maybe been obscured a little bit by the ASV and King James and some of the older translations, that that they heard the voice, but they didn't understand what was being said. Don. The word translated, there's some disagreement as far as what that means. Kurios is the word, and that can be translated sir. You do have that used sometimes in the life of Christ and applied to a man. So it's a term of respect. So exactly what Saul meant by that, it might be going too far to say that when he uses that word, he's thinking that it's deity. I mean, I think that would be a fairly reasonable conclusion. But again, to say that with absolute certainty, that might be a little bit difficult to prove.
Well, going back to your point that they had, you thought maybe they had fallen along with Paul, and then they got back with immediately. But do you think that they thought it was some force or power beyond if they imagined and heard his voice, that they would have gotten back up?
It is noon. Let's take a look at this. Is it in Acts 9 where it talks about it was brighter than the sun? I'm thinking it's Acts 22 or Acts 26. Okay, you want to read that? If you've got it? Okay, Carol's got it. Okay, so again, what's brighter than the sun? I don't know. That's his description, and somebody might say, well, I don't think it was brighter than the sun. Whatever this was, if there's a light that's bright enough, I mean, we've all walked out into the sun and shielded our eyes, or we had to stop for just a second so we didn't stumble. But if it's God's intent to stop this man on the way to Damascus, I have no doubt that it was an experience that was sufficient enough to really knock him down. Again, you're out there, it sounds like it's a fairly sunny day, it's noon, and this bright light shines out of, you know, nowhere, and I mean, it's just bang. beyond powerful is, I guess, the only way I could describe it, Don.
Yeah, I'm surmising that as Paul was prostrate, he was down on his knees or whatever, that the other in the group would have been just as odd.
Yeah.
This happened. They were prostrate too.
Yeah.
That they would not get up unless somebody told them to get up.
Again, the details are not there. That's possible. It's possible. But I am inclined, like I say, to put those two together in that way, that Paul is the focus, and they're able to get up, and something keeps Paul on the ground. And whether or not that is the conversation that the Lord has with Paul, and the other guys are thinking, you know, we're off the hook, okay? He's not talking to us. We're not understanding the language, but this guy is.
They hear the voice, get up.
Yeah. And again, that could have been, you guys can get up, Saul needs to stay down. I don't know. It's kind of like what we're talking about on Wednesday nights as far as some of the snapshots. We get some pictures here and here and here, and trying to fill in some of the details, we just don't have some of that additional specific information. We can make some suggestions, and that would certainly be one possibility on the list. Let's go back to Acts 22 and 26 and see if in those accounts you don't find there that he says the language was in the Hebrew tongue. Okay, I was in 22 first. All right, you want to read that? Okay, these others who are with them don't understand the Hebrew dialect, apparently. Brian?
Another option with reconciling the voice thing, it says that in Acts 9, 7, that they were journeying with them, stood speechless, hearing a voice but seeing no one. In Acts 22, they didn't hear the voice that spoke to Paul. So it could be that they heard a voice that wasn't the one that Paul heard. They did hear a voice, but it wasn't the voice of the one that talked to Paul.
Yeah, I'm not so inclined to take that as far as an explanation. I think that might stretch things a bit. We will talk more about that, so maybe hold on that.
Yeah, someone had made a comment that maybe they were told to get up. Maybe there was another voice that they heard.
Yeah, maybe. But when you take the passage from Acts 26 that Carol read, again, he seems to be specifying a certain language and implying. So, would that indicate that perhaps the people who were with them were not Jews? Maybe. Yeah. Well, yeah. The Romans versus somebody like the temple guard.
Well, I think the discussion that we've just had keeps pointing more and more to what you said just a little earlier, and that is we look at this as being one cohesive event, and it's not. It is an event with God and Paul, and it's an event with the others that were with them. It's not.
Yeah.
They're not both or all on the same page, in other words.
Yeah. I mean, God is interested in the others as far as their souls, but they are immaterial to this experience because God is looking to this guy. I mean, he's the chosen vessel, as we're going to find a little bit later in Acts chapter 9. So the focus is on him to get him headed in the right way. But the light is apparently, the experience is powerful enough to also knock all these guys down. But again, to kind of not keep them down, I guess, so to speak. Tim and then Betty.
I think we, probably all of us, would behave the same way that
sure.
Paul did, because here's this light that is so bright that it's blocking out everything else around them from their view. They're in this ray of light that's for
intents and purposes has trapped them right there. And they hear this voice, especially Paul or Saul. He hears this voice talking to him. So he knows right off the bat that this is happening because of him. And he's probably wondering, what did I do? You know, what's going on? And when he ended up on the ground, all the things he just experienced, plus not being able to see, that would make you not want to get up real quick, because you're trying to sort this out somehow.
But take that good answer and relate it to first century culture. You find some people who had some pretty strong ideas, ghosts and powers, false deities. Two examples of that. Remember disciples of Jesus late at night or early in the morning, depending on how you count time. They're in the boat. Jesus is walking on the water. And what do they say? It is a ghost. And then you think about the centurion at the cross. And he said, truly, this was the Son of God. Now, did he know that Jesus was really the Son of God in the sense that we think of it? Maybe, maybe not. But at least he understood that there's something about this fellow that is definitely not of this world. So people were already thinking in those terms to some degree. And if you're out there, the sun's bright, and something shows up, again, whether you are a Jew or whether you are a non-Jew, a Gentile, in that culture, based on a lot of the beliefs, better to be safer than sorry. And that seems to have been the prevalent attitude with some of those folks. You can go back to Jonah and kind of see that with the people there on the ship as well, going back much earlier as far as time, but safer rather than sorry, appease the gods. So even now, with what's going on in Hawaii, have you seen some information about the pagan deity down there that they think that has caused the eruptions? Saw one guy interviewed, and he thought it was a pagan deity that had been agitated. Betty? Yeah.
And were these guards and other authorities that were going with Paul to Damascus?
Maybe. Again, they could have been guards from the Jewish temple. Some have suggested they were Roman guards. To me, that seems to be a little bit of a stretch. Why the Romans would have been interested, I don't know. But if they were Jewish guards, why didn't they understand the voice? I like more the explanation that they were travelers, that here were people who were just headed this way. It was desert, and, you know, don't know exactly what their background was, and Paul just links up with them.
It says they traveled with him.
Yeah.
In verse 7, it says the men who traveled with him stood speechless.
Yeah. But I do like the idea that they heard the voice, and they decided to stand up at that point. Hey, there's communication. And it would make sense for...
But I don't understand maybe what they're saying. It's like, okay, let's see if we can see who it is.
Yeah, but you hear Saul, Saul, and it's, okay, it may not be safe for me. So again, I think that offers a logical explanation of the text. Let's see, Stan, and then we're going to go back to Don.
Okay, just a very small part of it, but you think of what we would do today. Suppose we were outdoors and lightning struck very close to us. What would we do? Boom, we'd hit the ground. And that's what they did. When it's gone, we're going to stand back up again. Mm-hmm. Now, what was happening to Paul, as I said earlier, I think was a separate thing. And so it doesn't seem illogical to me.
Yeah, and that's why I say I don't think that when you put that together, you would, if you're trying to look at things reasonably, you'd say, well, it's a contradiction. It's a natural reaction of people. Don?
Well, it's the same thought, much better, but you were saying, you opened that to somebody asking that did not really believe in the Bible, the contradictions. Well, Paul was first person, right? And Luke was second person. So he got his information from Paul, right? Inspired.
Well, I think Luke probably worked with a number of sources. When you go back to the book of Luke, for example, as the book begins...
Contradictions seemingly contradictions. You can't square everything by logic.
Well, I think logic is going to be a very helpful tool. You would have inference, which would sort of be in the area of logic, common sense. Some of it's going to be dealt with by faith. Not blind faith, but again, I think a well-reasoned faith. When you're looking for explanations, and especially if you're dealing with passages which people would refer to as Bible contradictions, the question becomes, here's what you say as far as something that can't be reconciled. A can't be reconciled with B. All right, I may not be able to fully explain how A and B go together, but can I offer any reasonable explanations? And yes, if you can do that, then again, the contradiction is not a contradiction. It's, again, I can't necessarily say it was like this, but I can offer maybe two, three, four possibilities, maybe more, which would be possible explanations for how A and B go together. For example, somebody says, well, how'd the lamp break? I may not be able to give a specific explanation. And you've got 10 kids in the house. Well, all 10 could have broken it. And you say, well, look, seven were staying with grandma out of state. Okay, I can eliminate those seven for sure. But can I eliminate the other three? No. Might I be able to say, well, I think child one of the three that was home was a little more likely to do that than the other two? Yes. And do I think that maybe kids one and two are more likely to have done that than child three? Yes. So even though I can't specifically nail down which child broke the lamp, I can offer reasonable explanations. And I would say that's the same thing that we're dealing with when people come along and claim a Bible contradiction.
And similar to what we're studying on Wednesday night.
Correct.
You know, these four gospels, they don't verbatim exactly the same thing.
Correct.
So it's the same thing, isn't it?
Correct. Yes. We have multiple possibilities, and you try to lay those out and say, here, ways that it could have happened. There may be some ways that it happened that I don't know. But at least we can offer some options here, and these are the choices that we have. Anybody else? Okay, let's talk about the word persecution.